the chairperson. Perhaps it would be easier if I just introduced them. As you know, Mr. Morris is here on my side, the director. This is his last meeting. I'm very, very sad to tell you, in the present capacity as director, he has taken a post as chief director in the Department of Safety and Security of the Western Cape Government. And he is, this has created a mini crisis. No, not a mini crisis, a major crisis for this body, for the inspectorate, simply because Mr. Morris has been with us since day one. He, in fact, started this inspectorate in 1998 when Judge Trengove was the inspecting judge. So right now, the important thing is to get a CEO appointed as soon as possible. That process is on the go right now, and then to look for somebody to take over from Mr. Morris. But at the moment, that is the situation. Next to Mr. Morris is Mr. Umesh Raga. He is the head of our legal services unit, and he's the person who was responsible for Chapter 3 of our annual report. Next to him is Mr. Michael Prusent, P-R-U-S-E-N-T. He is the Southern Region National Manager, which includes half the country, just the southern portion. And then next to him is Ms. Nene. She is an independent visitor. We, in fact, decided that it would be appropriate to have two independent visitors. Right at the end of the table, you'll see the lady with the curly hair. That is Ms. Kekana. And she has been, she's our longest-serving independent visitor, has been with us for the past 10 years, long before I became involved. And we're very grateful that she can also be here to make a contribution. And then between the two ladies, we have Mr. Adam Karlsa, who is the national manager for the northern region. That is to say, everything above Mr. Prusent's area of jurisdiction. So we're grateful that we have all the senior personnel over here with us today. Then, if I may proceed, you will receive copies of the annual report, and this is, in fact, the basis on which we are here today. You know, when I was a student doing a doctorate at Leiden University in Holland many, many years ago in 1970, they said you did a thesis and that you had to defend your thesis against the doubts and aspersions which might be cast on it by the members of the faculty. Now, I feel very much like that today. I'm here to defend the annual report tegen de bedenkingen van the portfolio committee, which I hope is not going to be too serious. The important thing is, once again, I must thank Mr. Morris and all the members for the hard work they put into this annual report. What I'm going to do is I'm going to deal with just a few of the aspects I've raised in the foreword, and then I'm passing on to Mr. Morris, who will then divide the rest of the work between himself and the other members. I feel it's appropriate for Mr. Morris to do so in as much as this is his last appearance as director of the inspectorate. I think the important thing, I don't intend going through the foreword, you've all had the opportunity to look at it, but I think the important thing is that we're a little concerned by the fact that we report regularly to your office and to the minister on a number of problems which have arisen throughout the country. And unfortunately, we haven't always had the any kind of feedback indicating whether or not our recommendations or suggestions are being followed, or whether, in fact, they're even being received. We're always grateful from Cindy. She always very promptly acknowledges every single report that comes to your office. But we've had a little difficulty elsewhere. And I'm not suggesting for one moment that it's because people aren't doing their work, but there's no way that we are able to follow up. It is still one of our big problems, as you will recall, we've mentioned on a number of occasions, the limitations and restrictions of our mandate. There's no way that we have no disciplinary powers. We have certain powers to investigate conditions and treatment of prisoners, treatment of, their names are changing now, but they say inmates or whatever. Well, I prefer calling them detainees in general. And what we have now is that if we had the power, for instance, if I had the power of a judge, when I visit a particular correctional centre, and I see something which must be dealt with immediately, like in now, like in yesterday, then I would like to know that I would have the power to simply issue an order there and then. Of course, that does have its problems, because the department might feel, hey, that's wrong, and take me on review, as any other judicial order can be taken on review. Now, that's a legal aspect that we would have to deal with. So, you know, there are pros and cons when it comes to increasing our powers. We must think very carefully. You can't simply have a blanket increase of our powers. They have to be considered very carefully, and we'd be more than happy to cooperate fully in considering what kind of extension of our powers is required. We've experienced a real amount of success. We met the ministerial task team just the other day, and their experience and their impression is in those prisons, in those correctional centres where you have independent visitors, there seems to be a really good vibe in the centre. Of course, there are always exceptions, but their general impression was that the independent visitors are doing a great job, and I think eventually that is the one thing that makes our office totally unique. That, and of course the fact that we are independent, and we are fiercely independent, because we believe that is totally necessary. We're not simply an extension of DCS. Even though we do rely on DCS to pay our salaries and our other costs. And we have also the good news that the number of the overcrowding has improved from 170 to about 138%, which is a great improvement. There's also been a decrease in the number of women and children in custody, and we're very happy about that as well. We are less happy about the question of the OSD and the 7-day work week. If that were in practice, it should be working quite well. It should be working perfectly. But it has given rise to also the dual shift, the two shift system, people working for 12 hours. I really have difficulty understanding how anybody can work for 12 hours and concentrate on the task at hand. I think that should really be reconsidered, and I know it's something that has been dealt with. It has also had the effect that the number of staff absenteeism, the staff absenteeism has increased. We've visited centres where there's just virtually nobody, and they are unable to do anything more than just give 1 hour per day of a bit of exercise or a bit of outdoor for the prisoners, and they're kept in their cells for 23 hours. We're very concerned about that, because it means that no rehabilitation program is really being effectively applied. And the whole idea of the white paper is that rehabilitation programs must be put into practice, and that they are indeed going to give rise to a reintegration of each and every person who has been rehabilitated into the communities from which they have come. We're grateful to see that there has been a move to migrate officials from head office to the various centres. We're just a little concerned that we don't see too much of that at this stage. We're told that is what's happening, but is it in fact happening, or is it simply an entry on PERSO, or have they taken up their designated positions at the various centres? There's a real need for that, and there are more than enough people, four inmates to every official. There should be no difficulty with the number of people who are able to do the job, as long as they are, I think, designated to those jobs in such a way that they can be as effective as possible. I'm leaving the whole question of deaths and so forth to Mr. Morris to discuss with Mr. Raga, and I don't intend going into that. what we would like to see, and I know that this is going to be dealt with, we're dealing with unnatural deaths, but we would like to see that every single death, and it's not too many, we're looking at about, say, 1,000 a year, that every single death should be followed by an inquest. Every single death in a prison should be followed by a post-mortem. Because we are concerned that what are described as natural deaths, when we receive the little notice on our SMS, on our cell phones, are not necessarily natural. And there could be any number of reasons why the person has died, even from suicide, because of the circumstances reigning in the particular centre. So those are also aspects which we've been dealing with. We've also dealt with OPCAT, as you can see. The reason why we're dealing with OPCAT is that if OPCAT should be ratified, and Mr. Morris will tell us more about this just now, it will have a very definite impact on our office. So we must know exactly where we're going. Is a national preventive mechanism, which is envisaged, going to be a duplication of what we already are doing, or should we be regarded as the national preventive mechanism as such, our office, because it's already doing the work which is envisaged by the Act? Those are aspects, Mr. Chairperson, which will be dealt with now by the various members of our team. Thank you very much. I hand over now to Mr. Morris.
Good morning, Chair. Honourable members of the committee, the format that we'll do the presentation, Mr. Chair, is that we'll refer to the annual report directly as our source document, and we shall very briefly just highlight some of the parts of the report, and I don't know if the Chair would prefer that we then open for questions after each of the chapters, or should we run with it and then get an indication from you as to when you would like to deal with questions.
Members will guide me, but we're here until 12. I would suggest that you, and it's 10:15, that you deal with it until about 11 o'clock, and at 11 o'clock hopefully you'd have covered everything you want to cover. Then we open up for substantial discussion.
Mr. Chair, then at the risk of oversimplification, we'll just run through it and so that we allow enough time for debate and interaction also afterwards. Chapter 1 of the report, page 11, really it gives us an overview of the state of our correctional centres. And there I think the first is the good news, is that we have succeeded in bringing down the level of overcrowding from 170% recorded in April 2000, that's the worst that it's ever been in the history of our country, to the current levels of 139%. Now that is significant, especially when we consider that worldwide correctional centres are suffering from overcrowding and increasing numbers. So we have actually performed differently from international trends in that regard. However, it does not take away from the fact that we still have one of the highest incarceration rates in Africa as well as the world, with about 3.5 out of 1,000 citizens being in our correctional centres. Of particular concern that we wish to highlight, Mr. Chair, is the list on page 12 of the 19 correctional centres that are really critically overcrowded, and we can't stress this enough. At these places, the conditions are horrific, and both Ms. Kukana and Ms. Mene works at these centres, and also without doubt in my mind, that the worst is Johannesburg Medium A, and Ms. Kikana has been involved there, Mr. Chair, now for a very long time, and she's also running a very successful plea bargain project, and that's why we invited her specifically to be here. We will speak a bit more about that. But what we're also concerned about, Mr. Chair, is that there's no equitable distribution of inmates, seemingly. Take, for instance, the case of Pretoria Female. They are severely overcrowded, and only 30 kilometers from there is the new Babiaans prison, where Babiaans Poort prison, which is only 36% occupied. So the question is, can't they make internal arrangements? And we understand that it may be a bit of a disruption, but now, you understand, we need to find a more equitable distribution of it. And also, lastly, on the question of the 19 critically overcrowded centers, is we don't see any evidence that the department has any emergency plans in place to deal with these places. We don't see extra nurses being deployed to these places or extra security staff. They simply let it just, you understand, the crisis will manage itself. Page 13, we gave you a bit of a statistical analysis of the trends of behavior over time in our prison populations, and again, the unsentenced inmates, we can see that there is a sustainable reduction in the numbers over the last 10 years. I think it's important to note that the rate at which our female unsentenced population is declining is much higher than the total population. And the children over this period of time declined by a massive 80% unsentenced. So there's been some real good results achieved in that regard. Again, Mr. Chair, page 14, we just highlight again the fluctuation in the number of awaiting trial population, and we are now going into the so-called boom period again. So November, December, January, every year, the waiting trial population soars. It shoots up because of the courts closing down, you understand, whatever, the people going on leave and inmates are then, and the department, the difference between your peak and your low period is about 8,000 people. So the Department of Correctional Services must now all of a sudden care for additional 8,000 people in their systems, which is already stretched beyond its capacity. And in terms of the sentenced inmates, Mr. Chair, again, we have seen a decline of about 17% over the last decade, which is also, again, as I said, quite a remarkable achievement. But what we have seen, Mr. Chair, and which we'd like to emphasize, is the sharp growth in the number of people serving long sentences. Now, there are two very accurate statistical indicators to use there. The first is the number of people serving life. Now, they have gone up from 1,400 in the year 2000 to a massive 9,600 people this year, which is an increase of more than 500%. Now, again, when you look at those serving more than 10 years, they have gone up by 128% from 23,000 to 53,000 people. Now, of course, Mr. Chair, the impact on overcrowding with long sentences is a delayed effect. We won't see it immediately now, but in 5 or 6 years we're going to see. And in the meantime, the reduction in the number of inmates serving less than 2 years have offset this growth. But we foresee that there's going to be an impact on the prison numbers in the next 5 years or longer. And it also, Mr. Chair, brings into question the legislation and some of the current sections of the Act that it exists. Look at, for instance, Section 77 of the Act that says the minister must consider all cases of life sentences. She must consider it parole. Now, currently she has about 120 to deal with a year. In 5 years, that's going to triple. It's going to become a full-time job. So the same with the work that the National Council is currently doing in considering the cases of life sentence or very long sentences supported by the political head being the minister, we are concerned that in 5 years, because of the sharp increase, that is going to become an unworkable system. And it may lead to litigation and so, and maybe a proactive approach is what is being called for. Mr. Chair, I know you've said it to us before, and I'm very careful in terms of going into the discussion of capacity, and you said 2.5 or 3.5 square meters. We mustn't mention it again. But I just want to make the point that there is still a lack of uniformity in correctional services in the way that they measure the capacity of the prisons. So when they come and they say this prison can house 600, the way that they calculate that differs. In some places, they calculate the actual beds. Other places, they use a norm of 3.5. In the New Van Rijns prison, they use a norm of 2.5. And that has a massive impact on us in determining whether the prison is overcrowded or not. And it's also important to note that the norm that they use, 3.5 square meters, were developed in the early 80s when inmates were still sleeping on the floor. And again, with this, you understand, if you have inmates working outside, probably you can reduce the bed space needed and you can spend your money, instead of building more cells, you could be building workshops or classrooms or so, so that the inmates do not spend their time inside. Mr. Chair, then on page 16 and 17, we've made a number of suggestions as from our experience and our interaction with other criminal justice role players on what could be done to reduce the numbers even further. And these suggestions are also largely based on the best practices that we have noted over the last 12 years. I would like to, Mr. Chair, just go to page 18, the first bullet there, in terms of the plea bargaining. Now, again, we have been asked, or Mr. Chair, if I may, research has shown that in a country like America and the UK where plea bargaining is being used, as much as 80% of the criminal cases are resolved by means of plea agreements. And it's a way that you can really speed up the criminal cases and the prosecution of it. Now, in our country, the latest figure that we got is the Western Cape is running at about 2%. Now, we have been involved in many pilot projects to give effect to this concept of plea bargaining, but the problem is that the National Prosecuting Authority, they expect from us, and Ms. Tikane is involved in that all the time, that she must convince or she must ask the inmates who are willing to plead guilty. Now, it's unreasonable to ask them to plead or to suggest to them to plead guilty until they know what's the offer on the table. You understand? It's a plea bargain arrangement. It's not just a normal admission of guilt. This is a bargaining process. And we have tried to emphasize in every forum possible that the success of plea bargaining, and this is the worldwide model that exists, the success of plea bargaining depends on it must be prosecutor-driven. When the prosecutor decides to prosecute, of course, if there's no case, he won't decide to prosecute. But when they decide to prosecute, they should at the same time put down a proposal for plea bargaining. We saw recently, Mr. Chair, that in the police, when the special investigating unit found the number of police officials that claimed for the allowance and so, that 755 cases were plea bargained in a matter of a week. So if they can do it there, why can't they do it in the thousands of cases of shoplifting and so that we come across continuously? Last, Mr. Chair, in terms of the sentence, page 19, last bullet, that I just want to highlight is again the question of how correctional services can mitigate the effects of overcrowding. And, Mr. Chair, sadly, the Section 11 of the Act that states that an inmate must be given at least 1 hour exercise has now become the norm. In many places, you understand, there's adequate opportunity for them to give more exercise, but you'll find they'll keep it on the clock 1 hour back, you understand. So we hopefully, with the amendment of the Correctional Services Act, Mr. Chair, and if you look at Section 35 of the Constitution, that 1 hour is just an indication from Correctional Services. The Constitution speaks about, you understand, human dignity, including exercise. Now, that 1 hour that Correctional Services has put down as the minimum has now sadly become the norm. And as a result, the vast majority of inmates are kept in their cells for 23 hours a day. Mr. Chair, that concludes on chapter 1. I shall also deal with chapter 2, and then Mr. Araga will take over chapter 3, Mr. Prusen chapter 4, with Ms. Tikane and Nanny supporting, and Mr. Carlos is dealing with chapter 5. May I continue, Mr. Chair? Chapter 2, Mr. Chair, it's just again, we set out on a project, and if I say we, the Judicial Inspectorate and its staff, set out on a special project during the financial year which were aimed at measuring the extent of the work and the rehabilitation and the recreation programs that are at the disposal of the inmates. Now, the chapter is written just to give you a legal background in terms of the link that exists between the objective of the department to provide inmates with rehabilitation and work programs, as well as the process that they need to follow in terms of the sentencing plan, and as well as then the mandate that exists on them or the responsibility that exists on them to give the inmates opportunities to work. Now, our project, Mr. Chair, is really a audit of programs. And during this project, we visited a total of 178 of the correctional centers, which constitutes 74% of all the correctional centers in the country. That's page 23. And during this visit, we conducted three tasks. The first is we had a structured interview with all the heads of prisons in the country, including all the educationists. During this structured interview, we then asked from them, what programs do you have, what infrastructure do you have, and that formed the basis of our audit. The second part of the visit was then a physical inspection of the infrastructure that existed. And during that, we physically went and we counted the classrooms, we checked the size of the workshops, whatever the case may be. And the third phase of the audit was then unannounced visits, mostly by our independent visitors, during which unannounced visits, they went and they physically went to the classroom and they counted the number of inmates that were there at that time doing a program. And all of that information was then fed into a spreadsheet, Mr. Chair, and we then used a data analysis software to test the sample and to make sure that the data is accurate, and we tested for data integrity and so on. And based on that exercise, we then made a number of findings. And the first one, page 23, is that we can say, Mr. Chair, with few exceptions, in actual fact, we have an 80% probability measured through our data mining software, but with few exceptions, only between 10 and 15% of inmates are involved in programs, even those that have so-called sentencing plans. We find often that they have the plan, but there's no program. So they do the admin and they spend a lot of time and energy in terms of doing the sentencing plans, but they don't have the infrastructure or even the programs to support it. So it's a bit of a, you understand, chicken or egg exercise in that regard. Outliers in the process in that stats, Mr. Chair, we need to mention that the private prisons or the partnership prisons, as we prefer to refer to them, as well as two of the youth centers, perform significantly better than the rest of the country. And there were a strong statistical link between the two variables, namely the nature of the center and the number of inmates involved in the programs. And therefore, we can say without doubt that in terms of rehabilitation programs, the private prisons and the two youth centers that we measured, Brandvlei and so to Leeukop to a lesser extent, but they perform much better than any of the other countries. Also a very serious concern to us was the low production levels that we recorded at the workshops. Mr. Chair, we at Poyando, there's world-class production workshops, but it's empty. There's just nobody there. The equipment is left to depreciate, and you know, that equipment costs millions of rands. We saw at the Kimberley New prison where they have industrial washers, and they use it to wash two pairs of socks or whatever. It's just that equipment is left to depreciate being wasted. And then also, Mr. Chair, we also found that a lot of the, because of the so-called belt-tightening exercises, there is no money left to buy training material. So you'll find a workshop where they teach inmates how to do to clothing, but they have no material to buy, or they have no bricks or mortar to continue with the work. In terms of resources, Mr. Chair, page 24, and I'll finish up now. What we found is the lack of uniformity and standards. At one prison, you find classrooms and full sports fields, etc. A few kilometers away, there's a prison with nothing. So therefore, the inmates don't have, there's no uniformity in the programs that are being offered to them. So they'll do a program in one, and they'll be transferred, and they can't continue with what they're doing. So again, I believe that it's necessary for the committee, maybe the chair, to drive a minimum standard document to say that a correctional center if they, for instance, cater for youth people, should comply with the following minimum standards in terms of classrooms, sports fields, etc. And my last comment on that one, Mr. Chair, is also we found in many places that the human resources of correctional services, especially the educationists, are so diluted that people become ineffective. And what I mean by that is they'll try to put an educationist at every little prison in the country. Now, if you want educationists, you can at best maybe run an ABET program. But there's no way that one educationist can run a full schooling program, because you need a math science, you need a math teacher, you need science, you need to... So therefore, none of the inmates can continue with their formal schooling. They can be kept busy, you understand, but they don't. There's no alignment with the education and the curriculum. So what we would suggest is that each of the provinces rather pool all those educationists together, and you have a provincial school. And if you then have an inmate that needs schooling, send him there for 3 or 5 years, get him to that he can do his formal schooling. Because the way that they dilute the resources now, Mr. Chair, it takes away from the value of the program. Last comment on that, page 25, and that especially I see Nikros also here, Mr. Chair, but we found that in 82% of our centers, and I think that is really remarkable, we found NGOs willing and participating in the rehabilitation programs from inmates. And I say this is significant, Mr. Chair, because they don't get paid for it. And many of them, I must say, you understand, the challenges and the obstacles and the hurdles that they have to cross in order to get permission to work in the prisons, I must just say, you understand, I can only appreciate the valuable work that they do. And I do believe this is an opportunity for us to really give effect to the statutory mandate of community involvement. But again, I believe that it's necessary for heads of prisons to be given a minimum set of standards, of service delivery standards, and say to them, you must have at least 50% involvement of NGOs or whatever the case may be. Mr. Chair, I thank you with those ideas. I then also hand over to Mr. Raka.
Thank you very much. Good morning, Chair. Good morning, honourable members. I'll be dealing with Chapter 3, which in your annual report in front of you starts at page 26. And that Chapter 3 must be read with the annex here at the back where we list the unnatural deaths for the calendar year for 2009, and that's at page 59. What we have chosen, one of our strategic objectives which we had set ourselves some time ago was the prevention of rights violations, and included in our focus area, or largely emphasized in this current period under review, were the incidents of unnatural deaths in our centers for that period. Members have obviously studied the annexure at the back, and I'm sure there are many, many questions arising out of those. At best, what we could do with the limited space that's available, otherwise our annual report would have been so thick, is give members a brief summary of what the department itself found in their investigation reports. And here, of course, I'm referring to the, I refer you to the schedule from page 59 onwards. Overall, what we have found with unnatural deaths, which has been our focus, as I've said, and we intend continuing that in the current year. In fact, thankfully, the Amendment Act of Act 25 of 2008 last year enjoins us to also write reports to the committee. So the committee would be a little more au fait with those deaths which took place post 1 October. But the emphasis on unnatural deaths will continue, and we intend increasing our inquisitorial role in these. But for this period, what we have found, generally, if you look at the schedule, I've broken it down and give you a sense of which inmates have died, unnatural deaths. Sentenced inmates, from the schedule, 42. Unsentenced, 13. And I've just gone through a couple of numerical figures for you, just to give you a sense of the schedule. The youngest inmate was 20 years old. The oldest was 59. On average, the majority age was between 20 and 37, which I think reflects also the demographic profile of our prison population. Those in custody that have died and served less than 12 months, there were 25 cases. They'd been in prison, served less than 12 months, and there were 25 cases of those. In fact, those who served less than 24 months were 31 out of the 55 that we have recorded. So the large majority of inmates who've died as a result of unnatural causes, so-called, have been there for a very short period and are reasonably young. Then, worryingly, and I'm sure if you looked at the schedule closely, you'll also notice that we prefer to classify deaths as homicides, which will include murders, which will include culpable homicides, etc., as in contrast to suicides. Homicides involving officials, if one had to calculate it, there were 18. 18 murders, I've used the term subject to, of course, a proper test, but there was a death, and it was as a result of an unnatural set of circumstances confirmed by a post-mortem involving a official or officials. There were 18. If one looked a little more deeply into the merits of those cases, and I have one or two files here, we won't have time, but I can just mention in passing where the department itself found. We received their investigation reports largely, we received them, and if we wish to inquire a little further, we ask them to inquire even more. Ebongweni maximum, in fact, you'll see it on that schedule, where I can only describe it, and the department had described it as there was almost a frenzy amongst warders who had assaulted the inmate that led to his death. It was exacerbated further, and I just use this example. We have reported this matter. In fact, we were approached by an independent pathologist in this matter at the instance of the family that asked the pathologist to do a further investigation. And what he had found, and these are experts, this independent pathologist had found that the cause of death might not have been attributable to blunt force injury, you know, with severe beating over a sustained period. But when he did a facial flap, for example, and he found that there may have been signs of suffocation. And I cite this example because it was raised with us, and of course the South African Police Service, who we referred the pathologist to, we reported, if I'm not mistaken, to the department itself, are important role players. Maybe as I say this, that the inspectorate can only do so much, and all these deaths need to be looked at in a much more holistic manner, of course. So the inspectorate can look at the merits or demerits of it. We disadvantaged by the fact that we bound by the papers that are sent to us, and we can inquire on the papers that are sent to us, and or conduct our own investigations. But very importantly, of course, we got the South African Police Service. And once they put a docket together, their docket then goes to the National Prosecuting Authority, who will decide whether to charge or not to charge. If they do charge, it's a criminal process. If they do not charge criminally, murder, culpable homicide, it ends up with an inquest magistrate. And an inquest magistrate, in terms of the Inquest Act, and I'll speak a little bit more about why we make the proposal as well to expand on what the judges said with regard to postmortems, but the importance of the inquest would be almost, if I can put it, the final leg in the criminal justice system, where a magistrate will determine the cause of death, whether, as the law currently stands, whether there was an offence or not which is criminally prosecutable. And If I recall, you'll notice from the schedule, in fact, that maybe I should turn to the schedule quickly and we can take questions later. Page 59, you'll notice that I've already raised the question of the average age, whether they were sentenced, not sentenced, or period in custody. And if we look at the last column, which is headed SAPS NPA Courts, the information that we've provided there, up until the 15th of September this year, we had continued inquiring from the Department of Correctional Services, and in some cases, because it's their duty, in fact, to close finally a death investigation in terms of the department's own rule and policy, they would have to inquire what has happened to it, any recommendations that were made either by a prosecutor and or an inquest magistrate. And you will notice that if we just break down, or if we analyze the last column, CAS numbers, those are South African Police Services case numbers, docket numbers, in five cases they were not provided. In other words, the Department of Correctional Services were not, they didn't have that information. Investigations, South African Police Service investigations that were not completed, 47. Now, we say that subject to an argument where the department had not been aware whether the criminal investigation in these matters, and as a matter of course, with an unnatural death, of course, the docket is opened, the department had not had that information on their file with regard to whether criminal prosecution had whether there had been a decision or not. You'll see, I think it was in one matter, if I'm not mistaken, where a decision had been made, where the prosecutor decided to, what they call, nolle prosequi, not to proceed. In the rest, unknown to us and to the Department of Correctional Services. Then, with regard to, again, I refer to the last column, inquests. And again, I say that that information ought to be, well, we obviously expect an inquest to be conducted as speedily as possible where prosecutors do not prosecute. The department had provided us, as at the 15th of September this year, where they indicated to us that three were not finalized. In other words, they gave us some positive information. And in the rest, they were just unaware. So I think the point I'm making, and I think the judge has spoken about it, and I've emphasized it, is that the Department of Correctional Services, yes, of course, the focus is on their safe custody of inmates, that inmates are detained under humane conditions, etc., etc. But once we look after, once with unnatural deaths, the department are also dependent on, and in fact public, parliament, by the other agencies, as I said, SAPS, Justice, etc., to look at things holistically. And I think the call we do make is that this kind of information, the committee interacts with the SAPS Portfolio Committee, with the Justice Portfolio Committee, and perhaps these issues can be raised correctly, so I think, with them as well, for their own inquiry. So we don't just look insularly at just the Department of Correctional Services. For time, thank you, Judge. Then let us talk about, the homicides are maybe a little more easy to deal with, evidentially perhaps. There's a death, there's violence, there's a pathologist report that might record blunt force injury, and there you can see it now. But suicides is an area which is often difficult. We've had the majority of unnatural deaths, of course, were as a result of suicides. And there, among sentenced inmates, there were 24 for the period, and amongst awaiting trial detainees, or I suppose post the proposals from the minister, remand detainees, there were 6. Now, in fact, let me also go one step further and say that you'll notice there, suicide where the department had indicated in their report there were pre-existing or previous attempts or possible indications of suicidal tendencies or previous attempts. There were five. Now, of course, to lawyers and to ordinary people, they'd say, but you know what, I think we could prove negligence there. In theory, yes, but of course a test would, you know, we'd have to go to a test. And again, I talk about the inquest. Of course, the inquest, well, I've emphasized the importance of the inquest, but if I can, to emphasize the importance of an open inquest. In other words, where oral evidence, of course, that's in the realm of the judicial officer. He or she will make a call on whether to call for oral evidence. And I speak without any fact here, but I sense that large number of inquests are done on papers, are done perhaps not inquisitorially enough, and as a matter of course. And I say this, I think Mr. Peter Durant, if I'm not mistaken, from Justice, at a previous hearing here or at the case law management, has spoken about a large number of inquests not finalized. And in the Western Cape, I believe they didn't have a dedicated magistrate and a dedicated prosecutor, which they eventually got. So without being able to show it, the indications clearly are that perhaps inquests generally are not dealt with quickly enough. And the call for the judges made with regard to a bit of thought, deep thought, with regard to whether the Inquest Act for people in custody, not include, of course, those who died from natural causes, and of course, speeding up the unnatural causes, and so with medical legal post-mortem reports. I think I'm going to leave it there. I'm sure members have many, many questions. Just to emphasize that the schedule, the information on the schedule comes from the department's own reports. They're not our opinions. The department has found these things. And I think I will leave it just there. Thank you very much, Chief.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I may just add two observations as well. And if you look at the schedule, for instance, the first observation that we would like to make is that often correctional services, when they find their own members guilty of severe acts of violence, and I would refer you to cases number 29 and as well as cases level number 11 and number 13, you'll find that the department found their own members guilty of severe acts of violence, and then the sanction that they give them is a written warning or at most 1 month suspension, 1 month suspension without pay. Now, if you're involved in that level of violence, you understand, how can we argue that that is an acceptable sanction? That's the first observation I would like to make, Mr. Chair. And then the second observation, as it pertains to so-called natural death, we also found that the record keeping of correctional services is very bad. And it takes us up to 6-7 months to get a basic copy of a death certificate, especially where inmates are so, where they die in the so-called outside hospitals. Inmate will fall sick, he'll go to the outside hospital, there he'll die, or you understand? And then 6 months later, we'll still battle to get a copy of the death certificate. So, and that makes our work, if we get a death certificate 6 months later, the body has been disposed of, there's no way that we can give effect to our statutory mandate by coming back to you to confirm the circumstances of those deaths. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I hand over to Mr. Prusen, Chapter 4.
Good morning, Chair, and good morning to the members of the Portfolio Committee. Chapter 4 is on page 34. It's a much more easier one where I'll be speaking to the dealing with inmate complaints. We all do know that the Judicial Inspectorate has been mandated to deal with complaints of inmates. But there are a few things that we would like to report around that the independent visitors, they are the major role players in terms of dealing with inmate complaints. And how they do that is like they would go and visit the center itself, They will be having an opportunity to meet with the inmates privately to consult regarding the complaint itself. And what we have realized as a positive offspring out of that is that over the years, there has now been an increase from the side of DCS of making available the registers where the inmates could have an opportunity to register their complaints. And but the problem that we do have is that it's around with the definition on dealing with complaints in terms of what it really means. Because what we have realized is that even though that those complaints have been registered, that there are still many of those complaints which will still remain as unresolved complaints within the own setup of the complaints procedure. So hence, like if we look at the recommendations being made in Chapter 4, is that we would like the JICS to have the power to deal with complaints, that whole section to be revised, and much more clarity should be offered in terms of how we should go about disposing of such complaints which cannot be resolved. And also need to mention, if we go to page 35 around the role of independent visitors, according to the Act itself, now the Judicial Inspectorate is required to appoint independent visitors in all correctional centers. So for this period, 2009-2010, we had like 239 correctional centers which were operational. We managed to create 280 IV posts. And during this period, we had 220 IVs, independent visitors. Now, among the 220 IVs which were deployed nationally, they managed to have about more than 8,000 visits to the correctional centers, and they dealt with about more than 78,000 of meeting with inmates and privately consulting with them. On page 37 of the annual report, we basically make, there's a table there that basically explains the number of complaints according to the number and the nature of complaints that has been dealt with. One of the observations that we have made after the analysis of the complaints is that for the past 2 years, in fact during this period also, that the main category of complaints that the IVs would have dealt with is the complaints around transfers, inmates complaining regarding transfers from one center to the another center. We also have complaints around the communication, where inmates will basically be requesting to be able to communicate with their families, and then complaints around bail, healthcare, and legal representation. And we do feel that some of those complaints, if through a better management of the centers and so on, can be resolved in one way or the other. The death table is available on page 37. Besides the independent visitors and so on, the inspecting judge also had the opportunity to go and conduct inspections himself. And the report is also available on page 38. Where basically I would like to highlight what the judge also mentioned earlier on, around the problems that the experience was, like around the issue of the two-shift system. It has come out as a problem that the judge had. And then around the detention of unsentenced girls. But all these reports, as we can read from page 38 and 39, have been submitted to the ministry and also to the portfolio committee. But like basically there, the report makes the different findings through the inspection that the judge has managed to conduct. On that note, I would like maybe to ask the independent visitors if they can add to that.
Mr. Chair and honorable members of the committee, I agree with what Mr. Tosan said. As people who are on the ground, there are challenges here and there because, I mean, my observation is like, you know, our mandate is to serve the inmates or detainees, Sometimes we come as if we are the threat, you know, to the officials within the center. But I mean, it's a matter of like working hard again and again to share our hearts. Our heart is nothing so much personal as compared to just to help the inmates, even to encourage even the members to see the inmates not just as inmates, but more than that. That there are people who, even if it's sometimes the complaint is seen as if it's a civil complaint, like toilet paper. I mean, but for them it's important enough, you know, to create that tension, because to be in the system is you know, causing that tension, you know, not to be with the family and that freedom, it's enough to cause the tension. So now, if you cannot just provide that toilet paper, it can create problems which couldn't have created if you just provided that toilet paper. And also with the conditions, as you could see in part of the report, which has been a concern again and again, the conditions where things are being broken. So it's always a challenge, you know, because, you know, the inmates will be saying, no, the windows are broken, it's cold, and all those sorts of things. And going to the HOP or some of the officials, they'll be saying, no, these inmates are the ones who've broken the, you know, the windows, and they've teared the blankets, you know, or the mattresses to close the windows or whatever reason. But at the end of the day, it's a problem where you think, but it's cold, it's winter, the windows need to be fixed. There's always those, you know, you don't know sometimes how to bring them, you know, the balance. At the same time, I mean, when you look at the awaiting trial, I'm aware that it's not that they are there for a long time. It might be some people who were there last month who broke the thing. But what about the people who arrived this week? They are not responsible. So it's an ongoing situation. I mean, we've seen a lot of renovations happening. We've gone through, you know, inspecting the whole thing. Everything is nice, the toilets, the showers. Everything is proper. I mean, as soon as the inmates come in, and, you know, a week or 2 weeks, everything is back to square one. So there are those challenges. But despite of those challenges, our hearts is to see, you know, to continue to push, you know, no matter how hard it is, to continue to bring that positive aspect. I am aware that with the officials or members who are working on the ground, it's not easy because they are there almost 24/7 of some sort. Sometimes it's strenuous, you know, to deal with the inmates, but it's, for us, it's to keep on to bring that positive, you know, impartation on them to say, you know, we know, we understand it's hard, it's tough, but still they are human beings, because it boils down to that they need to be treated as humans, as I would be treating my child, no matter how much damage he has done, but he's still my child, or he's still my son. So, despite of those challenges, I can still say as IECCVs or IVs, independent visitors, we are still excited about what we are doing, because we are seeing the improvement in different areas. I can just even say I'm excited about the number of the children which has been reduced. I think because of the Child Justice Act which has been implemented, I think the 1st of April, we've seen the number reduce in amazing, from maybe more than 30 awaiting detainees to maybe more or less 5 children who are incarcerated. So for me, I'm excited about that.
I'm Mata Kekana. My approach is some of the challenges that we encounter at the centers are because of the restrictions given to the Judicial Inspectorate. And sometimes you are getting some complaints that the head of the prison doesn't have a discussion over, and then you are having a complaint that the Judicial Inspectorate doesn't have a discretion over. For instance, if an inmate is coming from court and he's hurt, he's been driven wrongly in the truck, he's hit his head on a truck when the humps, because they're driving carelessly. When the inmate comes to you as the one who takes his complaint, you go to the ACC, and the ACC will tell you that something that happened outside the gates of the prison. So now you are standing there and you feel you are a failure because you can't help that inmate. And at the same time, if discretion could be given to the ACCs, that inmates that are coming in very injured in the prison, injured by the SAPS, they need to take them back. And I don't know where, to the hospitals, and then bring them back when they are cured. Because some of the injuries that come to the prison through the SAPS are really unforgettable. And we are trying as a referral body to send some complaints to the ICDs, and you never come up, you don't get anything out of that. And then if discussions could be given to Judicial Inspectorate and or to us to even visit the detention areas where the other inmates are coming from. For instance, in Johannesburg, we are having a problem about measles. And all that, every time the inmates are coming from the detentions, from SAPS, they are bringing something inside the prison. So, and then the other thing is the ablution system. If maybe the prisons could be given back to the back, like before, things were done by the inmates. We were not complaining about the broken system, like the flushing and things like that, because the inmates were there. Now, inmates are not given work. Inmates are being locked up for 23 hours. They're not given anything to do. And when you are complaining, it's always somebody is passing the buck to the next person. It's always the public works. And then things will be done when they come to the media. And then DCS will always say that it's either belt tightening or it's not our problem. It's the public works problem. And then we are sitting there with people who are locked up in a cell that is built for 38 people and it's got 80 people inside. Those are being tied together to accommodate four inmates. A bed that is supposed to sleep one inmate. There are two beds tied together to accommodate four inmates. That is a vast inhumane. I appeal that the judicial also to be given extension and to be given some power over the complaints that we are dealing with. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I can just again, one or two thoughts on the involvement of independent visitors. The system of independent visitors and the model that we have created in the Judicial Inspectorate. If you look at similar models that were established in terms of community involvement, you'll find tables, or let's say documents and on documents of systems that did not work. And one of these community involvement problems projects all seem to follow the same predictable pattern of problems experience. And one of the problems that they experience is when you start with it, you get people that are really and truly committed to the project. Once you start paying, then you are overwhelmed with people that want to be involved. But they get involved more for the job seeking than the involvement itself. And I honestly believe that this project of the Judicial Inspectorate or the IPVs are now at a very important turning point, because we see that our experienced IPVs are withdrawing from the system because their standing in the community is eroded by the fact that they are powerless to deal with the complaints.
And therefore, the people, they say, no, you understand, I'm not willing to put my reputation on the line here because I need to go and face those people outside. I observe assaults. I see things happening. We report it, and seemingly very little is done by it. And I'm concerned that this would mean that these people will, at the end of the day, basically withdraw from the project altogether. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I hand over to Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chair and the honourable members of the committee, Chapter 5 deals with community involvement. It is almost impossible to read this chapter and to deal with this chapter in isolation. Chapter 2, especially page 25, refers to the various NGOs and community based organizations involved in correctional matters and in correctional centers basically latch onto Chapter 5 that deals with community involvement. Therefore, one of the strategic objectives of the inspectors is to promote the community interest and involvement in correctional matters, because as we have already seen, that it is almost impossible for the Department of Correctional Services basically to deal, especially when it comes to rehabilitation. And rehabilitation has a direct impact on the amount of complaints that you will ultimately have in correctional centers. And one of the ways to achieve the promotion of community involvement is through our visitors committees, which consist of independent visitors. Visitors committees meet monthly, and as an ongoing goal, they invite the Department of Correctional Services. And for the last year, we have one of our achievements was that the Department of Correctional Services, the area commissioner, the head of the correctional center, or a designee a member of the department visits almost on a monthly basis most of our visitors committees. Legal aid in a very large manner also come to board and visit our in some visitors committees. They are there on a monthly basis, and by others they are invited regularly. Visitors committees serve as a mean whereby they quarterly invite other stakeholders. They invite NGOs and community-based organizations, faith-based organizations, and once again it is to promote involvement in community matters. Independent visitors through the body of the visitors committee are also involved within the community themselves, basically sensitizing the community of what is happening in centers, but they also reach out to community in Limpopo recently, and there was colorful pictures in the Limpopo newspaper where the visitors committee was involved in the old age home. They did various things to uplift the old age home, and also took some vegetables, which they facilitated the whole process. So not only do they invite, but they are also involved in the community. The essence of the community involvement lies within the appointment of the independent visitors who are recommended by community organizations, meaning that the process is not where individuals come and they apply to be an independent visitor, but it is communities who recommend them, and that is the process. So we liaise with them and we ask them to send and recommend people to serve that really have a passion for community work, but also a passion for correctional matters. Currently, we have 28 visitors committees nationally, and we also started a little bit more than a year ago where the chairperson of the visitors committee serve on the panel for the appointment of independent visitors, because they are on the ground, they have the feeling, they know the challenges and etc. So they also form part to try and appoint the best independent visitors from the communities. And lastly, on page 43 and 44, there's an outline of the partnership with other role players. Once again, Mr. Chair, I will request the independent visitors and also chairpersons of two of our visitors committees just to add and just to share their experience as chairpersons per se within our visitors committee regarding the community involvement.
According to the challenges that we are getting from the inmates' complaints and requests, we notice that we need an outside help from the NGOs that are working outside the prison. And then also we invited institutions like Human Rights, NICRO, we invited ICDs, we invited prosecutors, we invited people who are dealing with the appeals. We invited each and every person that we feel that can do an impact in alleviating the challenges inside the prison. And also recently we invited the CDW from the community. Because sometimes, for instance, there was a man that was arrested, and then the child and the man left a woman sick and the child, and then the woman died while the inmate was still inside. And there was a child of 9 months involved. And as an independent visitor, I'm not allowed to be working outside the yard of the prison. And then we used the CDWs to go and into the locations and find out what happened to the child and which social workers are involved, so that the man, after his sentence, or maybe if he is acquitted before a sentencing, he may know where the child is. And we are having challenges that really need social workers. I need to emphasize that to this house. The awaiting trials are not assigned any social workers. And they are stressed inside. They stay inside the prison awaiting. Some of them will be on awaiting trial for 7 years. And you ask yourself, what is this house saying? And you ask yourself, what is this discretion given to the head of the prison? Because if a person is staying there inside the prison, that person is not getting any rehabilitation because he doesn't fall under, he's not sentenced. He doesn't fall under anything that is DCS related. He's there, and then if you ask questions, you will be told that he falls under SAPS. And that man will be loitering and sitting there and be locked for 23 hours for 7 years. And then at the end, the man will be acquitted. For an example, last month, Mr. Van Rooyen, I got him there in the prison. He was only acquitted by the commercial court. He went scot-free, and he's been there more than 7 years. What is this house saying about this? And then we need social workers, because those people, they come, you know, they are mine. Some of them, you get to a person knowing this person came inside fresh, and you see the person deteriorating in front of you, and you are helpless. You can't help because there's no social worker. You cannot contact this person. You cannot help this person. His family died, and he's not sentenced. It's understandable if he's sentenced. But his family will die outside, and he's not sentenced. He's inside. And you try to ask the chief prosecutor or the chief magistrate, and it's not your duty to do so. So we really, really are asking though we are trying, some of the NGOs that we are collecting, they are coming on board and they are trying to help us. But I think also there are some legislations or rules or policies that are supposed to be set down and to help the awaiting tribes. Thank you.
We're just running over time a lot now, so I can just ask if you should keep it very short.
Quickly, I want to mention that last year we decided, as ICCV is working in Polmo and Goodwood, to take ourselves out to the community where we organize from our personal communities where we are coming from, invited the community, local, normal, not people who are, you know, of leaders of governments or something, and then try to explain, you know, what is our office, what is our mandate, and all those things. Because we are aware that, I mean, the normal person there, sometimes they are not aware of what are the procedures they can follow if the child is inside the prison, which was an exciting thing, of which we are hoping to continue with something like that to involve the normal person out there in the community. Another thing, last thing, with the communication with the families, it has been so helpful. I know that we are supposed to be working within the centers, but I mean, as human beings, you realize that it's supposed to be taking you more than just working within. So you end up finding yourself communicating with families, knocking at their doors, especially with the parents who have given up on the children, to encourage them, you know, come and visit, come, you know, to bring that perspective, you know, as a parent, that you cannot give up. So things like that as well, of course, it affects the budget and all those things, of which in this house I would really encourage that somehow to work together as far as, you know, making more, that the funds will be available if there's need for more phone calls or more visitation in within the houses. Because if somebody is an official coming into the home, it does make a difference, speaking on behalf of the inmate to the mama who has given up, or to a daddy who has given up, or uncle or grandmother. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I'll deal with Chapter 6 and 7 very quickly. Chapter 6 is just the President has signed the optional protocol on the Convention Against Torture, or commonly referred to as OCCAT. And it is our information that the Department of Justice is now making a submission to the Justice Portfolio Committee on the ratification of OCCAT. Now, why is that important to us? Because in terms of the OCCAT, they must be set up what they refer a national preventative mechanism. And that is a group of experts that are given the right to visit all places of detention. Now, because 80% of the people detained in our country are detained in correctional services, there will be a major overlap between the work that this body will do and the current work that the Judicial Inspectorate is doing. And we're just asking, Chair, that from your side as a portfolio committee that you get involved in this process, and that we do see that that overlap can be either minimized, or that we also look at you understand, creating and building on the sustainability of the model that we have. Otherwise, it's going to become a duplication, and there's going to be unnecessary waste in that regard. Last chapter, Mr. Chair, that's just really the household issues of the inspectorate. We have listed for your benefit the strategic objectives of the organization, pages 54 and 55. It's been the same the last 7 years. We have also listed just the amendment of the Act in terms of the staffing arrangement, page 55. And then page 56, you'll see a breakdown of the staff. You'll see that we have currently a permanent staff of 49 people and 220 independent visitors. Now, it's also maybe important for me to note, Mr. Chair, that the senior management of the Judicial Inspectorate has not expanded in the last 12 years. So we've kept it the same in during this period of time. Also important, of our permanent staff, 52% are females, of our IPVs, 55% are females. And 93% comes from this, the designated group as defined in the Employment Equity Act, and amongst the independent visitors, that is 99. Last year, this committee requested that we include information of action taken against our independent visitors, that is the, page 56 and 57. You'll see that during the financial year, we terminated the contracts of 13 independent visitors, six of which were because of misconduct and deliberate dishonesty, five because of poor performance, and two because of poor health. We have a turnover over rate of about 7% in people either accepting other employment or retiring. They are not included here. Amongst our own members of staff, Mr. Chair, 10 written warnings were issued during the year, 2 final written warnings were issued, and 1 member of staff was suspended for a month without salary due to the misuse of one of our vehicles. We have also included there, Mr. Chair, the successful cases that we have defended both in the CCMA as well as the so-called General Public Service Sectorial Bargaining Chamber in cementing the position of our independent visitors as independent contractors opposed to employees of the state. So in all three of those cases, the courts or the tribunals held that they meet the requirements of independent contractors and they are satisfied that these people are not employees of the state, further cementing, as I said, one of our strategic objectives of maintaining our independence. Total cost, Mr. Chair, the bill that you had to pay, 19.1 million rand. It comes to 0.16% of the department's budget. I thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much for the presentation. It is 11:30. Maybe I'll allow members to interact, but I have a proposal as to how we take this thing forward. Safe to say that it's probably the most depressing report I've heard in a very long time. And my own view is that we have to take this thing, we have to take it head on. We have to take it head on if, in fact, what you are saying to us, and we have no doubt that it is accurate. If what you're saying to us is accurate, we cannot sit back and pretend that this thing is not happening. But I'll allow members to interact with it, and then I will propose a way forward. I just have two. The first point that I'd want to make, and I just want to make sure that I've understood what was said earlier on, that this report has been given to the Ministry. Have they responded to any of these things, disputed them, challenged them, accepted them? That's the first question. What was the Ministry's reaction to having received it, or was there an expectation of a reaction from the Ministry to this report? That's the first question. The second one that I want to ask, and then I'll raise it to the members, I just want to refer you to page 60, and case, I think, number 4, I mean, this is for example. I think it's page 60. If you look at case number 3 and case number 4, and I'm sure other cases are the same, your chapter headed classification, person, and circumstances. Number 3 says mass assault of inmates by officials. Case number 4 says continuous assault. My question to you is, and I think you've classified this in the homicide or suicide or whatever you've classified them, why haven't you classified them as torture? Those are the two questions that I want to ask. Continuous assaults, and you know, this is the problem we've had in the past. You would say sexual assault when it was rape. Now you are saying homicide when, and unless I don't understand, I would classify this thing as torture. I mean, if it's continuous assault by many people. So those are the two questions that I want to raise, but, and then you'll farm them out. You'll take 2 or 3 questions, and then at some point we'll come back to you. We'll take Mr. Sal, then we'll take Baba Ndlovu, then we'll take Mangwenya. It is 11:30 if members can be as precise. We'll come back to you in about 10 minutes to respond to all the questions.
Thank you very much, Chair, and I concur with your assessment of the report. I'd just like to ask two questions, really. The one flows from what the judge said right at the beginning, and it goes to the independence and the office and the degree to which it's taken seriously. I would like to know what statutory or other changes would be required in order to give the office the teeth that the judge seems to think it needs in order to be taken seriously. In other words, does the Correctional Services Act need to change in giving additional powers to the inspectorate in order to be able to give a judicial order, to be able to make the interventions that clearly needed to be made? And allied to that, does the inspectorate have the capacity internally, bearing in mind that its management hasn't increased over the last 12 years, does it have the capacity to administer its own budget, to account independently to the Auditor General and everything else that would be required if it was a wholly independent body that operated perhaps as other institutions, other Chapter 9 institutions do? The second question goes to suicide, and I really would agree with your assessment, Chair, and others, that when you find a situation where, for example, in the case number 17 on page 64, that the person was found hanged on a gate in a passage during a recreation period. Well, a recreation period doesn't last very long, in my experience. And there was a shortage of weekend staff that was blamed, and then the department said there's no action taken. Nobody took bottom line responsibility. Likewise, there was a case in Durban Westfield, if I remember correctly, where the person was found hanged at 5:30 in the afternoon. Well, at 5:30 in the afternoon, still broad daylight, people presumably going up and down. What was it that was going on in that prison that allowed so little supervision that somebody was able to commit suicide at 5:30 in the afternoon? Likewise, a depressingly large number of people who set fire to themselves. How do they get the wherewithal to do this, and then there's no responsibility taken by the department at all? Now, what do we need to do as a committee in order to ensure that there's proper accountability for those cases? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Jefferson. The first question is overcrowding. I heard the judge saying that there is an improvement, but if you look at the table on page 12 of your report, it goes against what the judge was saying. If I can get the information, why he says that there is an improvement from 170% to 130%, something like that. That's the first question. The second question, Jefferson, when a person has been injured, coming from courts and so on, from SARS, what do they do? Because as far as I know, if a person is injured outside, they should be handed back to the SARS. The SARS must make sure that they find a medical something for that person or something. Do they take him in or whatever? What is the action if a person arrives at the gate and that person is injured from the court? What really happened thereafter? The last question, Chairperson, let's discuss about the shift system, because there is a problematic about shift system. Was there any recommendation from the inspector judge about the shift recommendations? Because it seems as if they are problematic, whatever way you find them. And I heard that the Chairperson will bail me out. Last week I raised some discussion about this matter. Because, you know, there were people who were locked out because of the shift problems at, you know, correctional centers, because of the shift problems. What is taking place with these shift problems? Is there any communication between the inspector judge and the ministry about it? Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. And also thank you for the presentation. Mine is on the on chapter 4 on page 37 in terms of the IPVs. Chapter 7, in 2009 IPVs recorded a total of 1557 complaints related to appeal. I want to know what kind of appeal are these. Secondly, and if this appeal related to their conviction and sentence, how relevant this is to the work of the inspecting judge office. Again, on page 37, Chairperson, on the bail, in the same period, 25,828 inmates complaints about bail were recorded. Are these awaiting trial, detainees, or sentence of or offenders? Because the report doesn't explain that. Then when you go down to the very same table again, on ADA, a report also indicated that 59,328 complaints about bail were recorded. Areas, are these waiting child detainees or sentenced offenders? A report also indicated 59,328 adult complaints were recorded. What constitute adults in this content? I don't understand law adults should obtain. And also from the complaint record in 2009, to what extent were these complaints resolved? It would have been useful to include this report, a table of unresolved complaints submitted to the visitors' committees, as well as table of complaints submitted to the inspecting judge, which the visitors' committee will not resolve. Konke lokho Chairperson is not included on the table. Ungangcono i-table leyo ichazise kahle konke lokho Chair. Chairperson, on page 21 under the audit of Correctional Center, chapter 2, the report is silence on issue of psychology and social worker, and I'm happy because CC they have touched that, and the report, it doesn't say anything in terms of psychologists, social workers, which creates the impression that all is well. So, is there inspecting reason for that? Lastly, Chair, the annual report indicates how much was spent by the inspectorial for the 2009 and 10 financial year, but it fails to indicate how much budget was allocated and how much was overspent in order to spend for that financial year. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. On page 54, number 14, it says found hand in single cell during morning unlock. No previous suicide attempts or indication. Official designated to perform night duty absent. Another official tasked to patrol two areas. Now, Chairperson, I would like to know if the other official was absent and the other officials was tasked to patrol, why there was no official there at that time? Because I've got a concern, Chairperson, on SAPS report. sub-docket open, outcome of criminal charges or inquest not provided. So I should think that person, somebody has to answer that, whether a sub or DCS. I just want a clarity there, Mr. Person. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairperson. The first question from your side was whether we had had any reaction from the minister. Now, we sent the minister and the deputy minister 5 copies each, and we make ourselves available, and in fact, we welcome a meeting with them to discuss the content. We have never heard anything from either the minister or the deputy minister. As we know, the deputy minister has in fact moved, but the new deputy minister has also been given copies of the annual report. So we are waiting. We're having a bit of difficulty making contact and communicating at the present stage. It does cause a little frustration. I'm hoping to meet the minister as soon as possible. To meet the new deputy minister, but we haven't been successful in that regard. I'm not blaming anybody. It may just be that they have an incredibly busy schedule and they aren't able to get back to us. As far as the question of whether these continuous assaults and these very serious, savage assaults on inmates should be classified as torture, of course they should. But we haven't been doing that for the simple reason that we've been dealing with them purely as specific cases of unnatural deaths which have been caused by this. But if we were asked to give a comment on what we believed, and for instance, if I were to comment on many of these cases, I would say that many of the people who were involved or who refused to become involved when they should have been involved should be, in fact, exposed to both criminal and civil procedures. Civil and criminal and civil litigation because of what appears to be a total lack of care, total negligence on their side. But we do have the situation of people who are being assaulted on a regular basis. They attribute it to frustration, they attribute it to a frenzy, they attribute whatever you want to call it. It's a totally unacceptable situation. The people have already been punished. Every single inmate in the centre has already been punished by a judge, by a judicial officer. The incarceration as such is the sentence. And there should not be this kind of conduct further, which amounts to further actions of a punitive nature against people. We'd be quite happy to classify these as torture in the future for cases when it comes under the definition and when it falls under the definition of torture, as you find it in OPCAT and in CIT and CAT. If I may refer to Mr. Self's question, how do we statutorily envisage? Well, I think probably the changes which we have in mind would probably require statutory intervention. The exact wording and the exact extent to which, of course, is something which can be debated, and I think it's something where we would look to Parliament and to this particular portfolio committee to give guidance. But we've given you an indication of where we find ourselves totally restricted by the limitations of our mandate, and it does cause frustration. Because we are unable to follow up. We do try to monitor these things again, but we have no indication whether the department is becoming involved at all. And that is where we are hoping that the portfolio committee, which gets all the same reports as we send to the minister, would be asking the minister, what have you done about this? Has anything been done? If so, when, by whom, and where, etc. That is the kind of thing that we would be most grateful about. We'd be more than happy to assist in drafting any amendment which we believe and which you believe might be necessary to try and achieve this. We've been trying to get our own email address. We are still under dcs.gov.za. We've been wanting to, as you have with the public protector, to have our own .org. as to make it as independent as can be. It's just difficult. The question of our, perhaps I'm going ahead to one of the other questions. We've been making do with one director and the other officials you've seen there for a long, long time, simply because we've been so strapped cash-wise by our budget. We've tried to keep it down as low as possible. But if we're going to have, if the detention, places of detention should increase to include police stations, et cetera, et cetera, we probably are going to have to increase the number of personnel substantially. And that is something also we would like to discuss, and we could, of course, always place something before you specifically in regard there. Mr. Self, you also asked about administering our own budget. Of course, we do that, and I know that was one of the questions which later came. How much was allocated and how much did we overspend? I think I'd ask Mr. Morris to deal with that. Then the suicides. The suicides, to me, are, most of them were probably preventable. And I find it totally, totally unacceptable. In fact, quite amazing that these suicides could take place there, literally in the passages, in the washrooms, when everybody is awake and walking around there. How it was possible, I don't know. All I can say is a total carelessness on the side of, and I'm not expecting the inmates to help, because as far as they're concerned, this is somebody else doing that, but that there are not sufficient staff on duty to ensure that this kind of thing doesn't happen. Where you have a case where five of the people who committed suicide had already given an indication before, and nothing happened. Angelique Soulier, I reported on her case to you. The lady here in Palsmoor, she told him she was going to commit suicide. She committed suicide. There was nobody nearby to assist. Of course we need psychologists. Of course we need social workers. But, you know, there is such a dearth of these people. We don't have enough people to teach. And that's why Mr. Morris said, if we can only get a nucleus of people who could work in different centres, at least we'd have something. But every single, well, certainly every large centre requires people, psychologists. There are so many vacancies there, or the posts just don't exist. So we would like to see and have as much support in that regard, because we believe it's essential. Ms. Ndlovu, the question of overcrowding, we were looking at this generally, as far as the figures are concerned. The 19 overcrowded centres that we refer to, those are really the crisis where they are drastically overcrowded, but those are the exceptions. Fortunately, there are 239 operational centres, and there are 220 others. 220 of the 239, which don't have that same kind of overcrowding situation. But once again, I think we've discussed this on many occasions. If you can reduce the number of awaiting trial detainees, or as they seem to be called, the remand detainees, this matter might be addressed properly. As far as whether you heard Ms. Kekana talking about inmates coming back from court and being severely injured because the SAPS truck that was conveying them to one side was totally overcrowded. I mean, it was like one of these buses or these taxis, which are, they have twice as many people in there as they should. And then they travel at speeds which are just totally dangerous. And they never, ever call to account. And that is one of the, once again, we would actually need the power to be able to say, listen, before you even start that vehicle, let us see what you've got inside. Whether these people are properly, whether they are able to be transported in this way, and or whether you just have an overcrowded vehicle and should let a second vehicle come over. Of course, SAP should be responsible if it's their people. They should be liable for any kind of injury. But the long and the short of it is, I believe that the moment they leave and get into that vehicle becomes an extension of the correctional centre. and the custodian remains the correctional staff. In other words, the people who should ensure that not too many people get into that SAF truck should be the officials at the center. And the same applies then for police cells or court cells where they are held. That is also an extension. The hospital cases that we were referred to, the moment somebody is placed in an outside hospital, that hospital, certainly that ward where the person is kept, becomes an extension of the correctional center. And we have the power to visit that. We just don't always have the personnel to do that. And then the question of the shift system, we were asked, I think it was in Global, yes. The shift system, we were never asked for our opinion. We were simply confronted with a situation, a fait accompli. And had we been given that opportunity, my first question would have been, how do you expect anybody to work for 12 hours and still be able to concentrate and do a proper job? And we've raised this on a number of occasions over the past 18 months or so, since it's been introduced. The question of appeal, you refer to, Ms. Ngwenya, at chapter 4, page 37. What we are referring to there are inmates complaining about the fact that they have raised an appeal or that they've brought an appeal against conviction and or sentence. And they say, nothing is being done about my appeal. And that's also why they complain. We don't have sufficient legal representation. That's a kind of complaint which comes to us. There's very little we can do about that, because once again, that would mean that we would be coming involved with legal aid and with the legal representation. The question of bail, that refers to, of course, awaiting trial detainees or remand detainees, because it only applies to people who are awaiting trial. Bail doesn't apply to people who are already convicted. Parole, yes, but not bail. So many of them have complaints. They cannot pay the amount of bail. That's where that's why I've already argued on previous occasions. The Act, the Criminal Procedure Act, should make it easier for people to be able to come before a court once again where they can't pay bail, and other conditions are laid down which don't include payment of money. Because we live in a country where 80% of the population is poverty-stricken, a large percentage. And then the question of other. Well, you heard that Ms. Kekana was talking about toilet rolls and this and that and the other thing. For instance, we've had cases where they don't have dishes, they don't have plates, they don't have knives and forks, not even plastic, you know. And they make use of all kinds of make-do implements to be able to feed themselves. That is totally but totally unacceptable. That's inhumane. We regard that as such bad treatment, and it's so in conflict with their basic right to dignity. And then as far as the table of unresolved complaints, yes, we do have a table. They are not included here, but we do have a table. The unresolved complaints come to our office, and we try to deal with them. And that is where we try to get Department of Correctional Services involved directly. In fact, they come to me, and then I can discuss this with the National Commissioner, and hopefully we are able to deal with those. They are few and far between. They are a tiny percentage of the large amount. By far, the great majority of these complaints are dealt with and resolved by persons such as these, who have given their testimony here today, and I'll be so grateful that they're here for that very reason. They do a magnificent job. And then as far as I've already spoken about the psychology and social workers, and now the question of budget and so forth, may I ask Mr. Morris just to speak about that?
Chair, the internal capacity Mr. Self spoke about, so we administer all our own budget. So we make all our own payments, we pay the independent visitors directly. We don't have a system where the head of prisons does any of our administration. We do it totally independent. That's also a requirement of the Labor Relations Act in terms of them been defined. So they submit an invoice to us. We've designed an electronic system and SMSs, but we deal with it without ourselves. In terms of the shift system, Ms. Gould just asked, sir, what I would warn you about, what is happening in correctional services now, remember you have what they call the partial system, and that is the system on which they administer their salaries and their appointments, and the, as they call it, the post. Now, you'll find that people are migrating in on the system. They're migrating from the office post to a center post so that they can earn the higher salary. But in actual fact, when you get there, they're not in the work prison. They're still working in the office. It's happening. It's in many of the places. At Portsmouth and many of the other centers, this migration is simply a transaction being made, and in the process, your salary is now increased because the center-based posts pay much more than the office-based posts. So that is what's happening in terms of the migration of people on the so-called shift system. But also the whole question of staff shortage, we're saying we shouldn't look at that in one dimension, a one-dimensional argument. We should also look, Mr. Chair, at absenteeism rates. Our report on the visit at Sanin and Louis Trichardt and Cardu, also we recorded and we measured actual absenteeism rates. And, Mr. Chair, you'll be surprised by the measurements we made. We're talking about 30-40% of staff being absent on any given day. If my memory serves me correct, they had at Makadu on New Year's Day. I think they had 4 members of staff working there, including the head of the prison, out of a possible of 160 members of staff. But all of that was included in our reports, and it was sent to the department on that basis. Lastly, in terms of the budget, ma'am, as I said, we administer our budget ourselves. We asked for 23 million, we were given 19 million, and we did not overspend. But remember, because our budget is so small, we can do changes, and we liaise with correctional services in the final reading of the budget to make the final adjustments. Our budget, as I said, constitutes 0.1% of their budget. So it's very easy for them just to make that final transaction to make sure that we our budget, therefore, are balanced. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Next, anybody else?
Thank you, Chair. Chair, yes, I totally agree with you with regard to this, the contents of this report. Damning and very worrisome. We cannot. Firstly, I just want to ask in terms of the people who's been employed as contract workers, the ICVs, and if they are contract workers, you stated page 52, the appointment are for a fixed a non-renewable period of 3 years in order to prevent them from becoming institutionalized. I just want to know from in the position of Mrs. Kikana whether there was any exception on the rule. The other point is, Chair, you can recall we requested from DOCS, DCS, he's going to DOCS, a turnaround strategy, which I didn't receive. I don't know whether the committee secretary received it. And I think the contents and the problems indicating in this and the recommendations indicating in this report should form part of that particular turnaround strategy. Government cannot spend 19 million rand on a body like this, which makes recommendations to improve the conditions of the inmates. And then those recommendations have been simply ignored and not complied with. And then we sit with the lack of power to enforce those things. I was looking for time frames in which this body checks recommended that certain things should be addressed, but I couldn't find any time frames. However, certain circumstances, and especially a judge heading this department, who is one of the sole guardians and protectors of human rights, to ensure that people are not being violated those rights, then they are staying in places which is infested by cockroaches and stuff, which is totally, you know, against our constitution. And by allowing the situation to continue, you actually become involved, not contributing, but you have maybe become an accomplice, because there's no real action to stop this type of practice. So I think that is a very problematic situation. I would like to see that we take a decision later where we are going to demand proper feedback from the department what has been done with regards to issues raised in this report. With regards to the minimum sentences, which the Honourable Judge mentioned here, it's a problem and it needs to be reviewed. I just want to know whether there was some lobbying from organizations to review that particular law. With regards to the work, to let offenders work, and the same report, in the same breath, we are saying on page 23, you cannot compel an inmate to work. How do you marry those two? That we need them to capacitate themselves with skills, and the other hand, we cannot compel them. With regard to suicides, my experience is that in some of these cases, where this suicide is questionable, that in some instances there are collusion between inmate and officials, where officials have been told, listen, we are going to have a deal here. You don't interfere there. So there's a blind eye, you know, to that particular thing, and then they murder somebody. And I totally agree that any, like with regards to the police, in any detention facility or any cell there, the ICD, whoever investigate to determine whether was the police is responsible or was there any negligence, and make the necessary recommendations. In this regard, I think it should be compelling that autopsy has been executed, because in cases where there's serious doubt about whether there was a criminal act committed or not, it takes, like the Honourable Judge said, that the majority of our people are very, very poor. And those families need to hire now an independent doctor to conduct this particular autopsy, where it could have been much better when the government actually made that contribution, because if the child or the family member is a criminal, the whole family is not a criminal. They are not criminals. So I think this is one of the things which we have to really put the focus on. And this don't care attitude of the department with regards to the reporting of this, and to make sure that death certificate is available for this body. That's a very, very important body, which is the watchdog, like the ICD on the police. It's totally, totally unacceptable. Chair, with regards to OPCAT, when I studied this report, there's a lot of similarities. Here and then, an extension of the responsibilities to the cells and other holding facilities, which is not DCS responsibility. I think, in my view, I'm of the opinion that 80 or 90% of the work has been done by this body. We need just a review to see whether, I think we are going maybe to debate it, to extend the powers of this, and also the capacity to deal with the additional responsibilities. Otherwise, other than to create another body which will cost the taxpayers another budget of 19 or much more millions to do the same work. Chair, I believe that, you know, for the department for not complying with these recommendations, there should be consequences. Otherwise, if there's no consequences, like how they deal with their personnel for these serious allegations of assault and stuff, getting written warnings. It doesn't serve as a deterrent. So in this case, when the Commissioner of Correctional Services got this, he or she must know within a particular time frame, they must react towards these recommendations properly to the different levels. Otherwise, we're going to waste taxpayers' money where we could use it differently and better. But here, we are dealing with human beings and we have to uphold the Constitution. Thing.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thanks for the report. I've got something that I want to ask. The inmates are being kept in the center. Some of them are sleeping in one bed, being three. And what is the judiciary doing about that? Because they are in charge to look after these people. You can't sleep in a bed, being three. That's my first question. My second question is that one of Ebongweni. You are saying an inmate was suffocated. By who? Where was that blood coming from? What investigation did you make to find out the plastic? Where was it from? My third question is that of Triple P centers. The Triple P centers, you are saying, they've got a program. Program, plan, everything of the centers are accurate. Why only them? What about the other centers? And my last question is that you are saying some of the centers, education, this commissioner who are in charge, when you go to the centers, we are told one inmate will tell you that I want to go to rehabilitation, but I'm told I'm not allowed. Why? And I've been here for 5 years, but I'm not allowed to go to the rehabilitation. I just want to find out from you people, do you sometimes have such complaints that we have when we go to the center? Thank you, Chairperson.
Thanks, Chair. Thanks for the report. I'm on page 38. Findings and recommendations, number 2. I just want to find out when was the application done in regard of number 2, and how far is the process gone. And another one on page 39. I'm getting confused because I don't know whether the question is direct to the inspection touch or to the DCS itself. Because some of these recommendations, I think, are with them. And therefore, we should just wait for the DCS to find out how far they go with the recommendations. Because they are recommending to the department. And the department must do something about them, not just to sit with them. It is our duty as this committee that we should ask the DCS how far they go with these recommendations. Because As myself asking them, I refer to this one because they are the one that has done the application, I suppose, so, for number 2. Then, Chairperson, on the issue of the shift system, I think this committee of ours should interrogate this matter again. We should interrogate this matter again with the department and the unions, because to me, there is a problem. We should not run away. There is a problem. That's my comment, Chair. Thanks.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chair, I think I'll support a member in terms of the challenge of the shift system. Always, department, when they report about this, they report as if everything is fine. And for them to do that, we cannot get any help. We are going to see always challenges. We would like to thank you as you go to visit, because your observation in terms of that is not a deeper than the observation of us when we go to oversight. We have observed that. But Chair, I want to answer Umama Ukekane. Am I right, Siswa? She has raised the concern that we were having. I'm sure 2 to 3 weeks we're raising this concern as this committee in terms of our waiting time. That are sitting in our center more than 7 or 8 years. Or it was not legislated, that act, in terms of correctional service. But I wanted to get from you, Mama Kekane Uguti, on what the department wanted to start in terms of the period of ama waiting time of finally hours aihlale, let's say a waiting time and a ukuqeda 5 years, but kuna le department ezanayo yokuthi umuntu akufanelanga ahlale more than 24 months. I wanted to get from you, what is your view in terms of that? Because personal, I've got challenge of that, Chairperson. Because lapho sinikeza amapolisa ukuthi ayo investigator futhi isikhathi esincane. Kungakho ke ngithanda ukuthi ngibuze lo mbuzo njengomuntu osebenza nomphakathi ngaphandle ukuthi niviwa njani le 2 years okuyikuthi kuziwa nayo manje nina nithi, ngoba ngempela ngempela iyasiqaba. That's why kutholakala ukuthi umuntu uhlala e-trial for 5 years, emva kwaloko isigwebo sakhe akagwetshwa sometimes uyagwetshwa. So kuba yinkinga ye correctional service, and ngiyibona ngigijima khona laphana kuma awaiting time. But ngifuna ukusho-ke ukuthi kuhle nikwenzayo, kodwa kukhona okubi okunye nikwenzayo, ngesizathu sokuthi noma ngabe thina senza ama-oversight, abanye benu bafika sesiqeda sesihamba singakwazi ukukweshina kubo ukuthi yezithi ezinye iy'nkinga enihlangabezana nazo or la thina singafinyelelanga khona masenzi oversight. Ngizothanda ukuthi-ke nikhuzane ukuthi hhayi cha, abanye bayasirobha bakhola mahhala. Ngiyabona.
Thank you, sir. I don't think mine is a question, but it's only to say, as this committee, I think we need to really, really enforce the issue of time frame. You know, to come back to the issue of the findings and the recommendations from the judge just mentioned that they sent 5 copies to the minister and nothing has been happened. So I think as this committee, really, we are sitting with a problem whereby we will send reports or wherever to the department or to the minister, and nothing has been done. So as this committee, we have to enforce a time frame, who is doing this, and where, and how, and what time, so that in future we don't sit with this problem that they will recommend and nothing has been done. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. I think Mama Ngwenya's question to Mama Ngwenya should be dealt with first. So I'll ask Ms. Kekana to answer that question.
Thank you. I don't know what to do. You understand the question?
I'm asking you, sir, did you understand the question?
No, not at all.
Okay, let's try and summarize this for you.
Yeah.
I'm going to have 2 points. The first point was that she thinks that the the IVPs are robbing us slightly, in that when we get to do oversight visits, they're not there to share with us what is it that they have picked up, and she feels that sometimes they're not adding value to it. That was the first one. The second one, Ms. Kekana raised the issue about sometimes you get people in a waiting trial so long that people die outside there, they've not been sentenced and so on. And Mama Gwenya was just highlighting the fact that the bill before us reduces it to 2 years. And what is their view is 2 years is sufficient time, too long, too short, whatever the case might be. In other words, the 5 years is not going to be an issue anymore if this becomes law. However, she was soliciting her views on the wisdom or otherwise thereof. Thanks, ma'am.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you very much, ma'am. I love your questions. They touch my heart. We would love to be with you. Always, I was like a fly in the milk. Whenever I see visitors coming into the gate, whether I know who are they or I don't know who are they, I used to follow so that I can pinpoint things inside the prison. Even the previous portfolio committee, they would come here and vouch on that. They would get me at the prison even at 3 o'clock. I knock off at the prison at 4 o'clock. I want to know what is happening in the prison. I get there at 6:15 in the morning. And then I sign my name on at 7 o'clock in their books, and then I will leave the prison at 4 o'clock. And my HCC can vouch that. The first thing is, we would really love to be there. Must be communication between us and this office. Whenever you want to come there, we must know that you are coming there. Because sometimes you will come there, and you go inside, and then I won't know. Maybe you will go and look at the inmates in cell number 1 and cell number 2. Maybe I'm inside cell 17 and cell 18. Nobody has notified me that DCS is going to have visitors, unless maybe I'm involved. Like maybe I would slip the RC a phone call. Please, can you come? Don't tell them that I said you must come. That's what I do sometimes, you know. And then, or maybe if the RC, or maybe you read something on the paper and then you go to the prison. We don't know. And most of us, I can put my head at Johannesburg. We are doing our utmost best to change that institution. We are doing our utmost best to change that institution. We are looked at, we've been called into meetings, and then we are being told that we are watchdogs, we are being called names. I even stood up, I said, I'm not going to be diluted by DCS. I'm independent, and I've come here for a purpose. But the only main thing is, we are both here for the same purpose. So to make the environment conducive to the inmates. If you are doing something right, you would not be scared of seeing Mrs. Kekana around, because you know you would be doing something right. But if you are doing something wrong, you will give names to Mrs. Kekana. So we are having that, and that was other application that a request that I was going to ask this office. The section from section 85 of the Judicial Inspectorate must be put instilled at the college when the officers are being trained, because some of them, when they come there, they don't know us. We are not appreciated, not at all. We are looked down at. We are not taken as people who are trying to do changes. So if this office can notify us whenever you are coming down, you would get some information. I was always interacting with Mr. Bloom, and he gave me his card. I would tell him, this is what is happening. Can you please help? I've tried the HCC, I've tried the area commissioner, but things are not changing. Can you help here? And when he comes, he would say, on such a date, we'll be there. He would get a list of all the challenges that I'm having. And then I would give them and say, go and discuss in the parliament. These are the things that are happening in the prison. Okay, let me pass that one. Let's go to the two-year thing. By law, before you take somebody into custody, you must make investigation to make sure that there's something that links this person. For instance, for just an example, I'm having two boys there. They are from the Lunga family. The other one is coming from KwaZulu-Natal to come in and visit the brother. And then the brother fought wherever he was. He fought with somebody, and that somebody died. And then when the police came, they got them, both of them, inside the house. The poor child, not knowing even the west and the south of Johannesburg, was taken with. And they said, the court will release you. That child is still there, and he didn't go to school. This is the second year. He's in custody, and the case is still going on. Who knows? They might be there for the next 5 years. I interacted with the father. They are separated with the mother. The mother, she's drinking too much. She doesn't even come to the prison. And with this belt tightening, those kids are suffering. They don't have clothes. They don't have toiletry. We are struggling from the churches to get them stuff. I made it the most simple thing. I phoned the father. I located him at KwaZulu-Natal and said, can you just send some money just for the kids to have something when DCS doesn't have, to buy soap from the internal shop? And it will be registered on their account. The small one haven't got shoes now. So putting people for a long time for things some of them didn't do is really unfair. If SAPS would make sure, before they brought somebody to the prison, that he is linked, then we wouldn't be struggling and talking like this. But some innocent people are being taken inside, and they would stay there for 5 to 7 years, only to find out that there's no evidence. You are not linked. So, Mama, I would welcome the 2 years.
You know, when I hear that, I really feel I'd like to burst into tears, because what she's saying there is the kind of problem we're having, not just at that one centre, but throughout the country. Mm. And also, this answers Mr. Max's question, why is Ms. Kekana still there after 10 years? We cannot do without her skills. She has incredible skills, not just plea bargaining, but dealing with caring for inmates, awaiting trial detainees, taking the trouble to phone a father and say, please send money. So that is the reason. She's a special case. She's exceptional. And we would like to keep her as long as possible. So thank you very much. Thank you, Ms. Kekana. You know, you in fact, I think, encapsulated what the problems are that we're dealing with virtually all the time on a daily basis. The question was, I think the first question related to page 64, number 14. Let me just see where that one is at. Oh, yes, the person found hanging in a single cell during a morning unlock, no previous suicide attempts or indication. Official designated to perform night duty absent, another official tasked to patrol two areas. So obviously you've got the other area when this happens. The fact of the matter is there was just no proper supervision. And the least you would expect is, particularly in cases where people now here you have a person who is not an awaiting trial detainee, but who obviously has been in a single cell. Now, the moment a person is segregated, that person must get special attention because there may be, we don't know what the reason is, because in terms of the amended act, every segregation must be reported to our office. Unfortunately, we have established that very few of them are, a relatively small number, because for some or other reason, they regard this as part of the larger system, and it's not really a segregation. They don't interpret it as a segregation. So the question is, we wish we had the answers to this, but we don't. And then the next question related to contract workers, Mr. Max. They are contract workers. And of course, the relationship between us and these workers is one based contractually. They don't have access to the CCMA, although labor relations and labor will also, of course, always play a role in this kind of thing. Mr. Morris can, in any event, just enlighten you a little more about that, because he's been dealing with many of these cases, including, you know, appearances in CCMA, where they've established that this is not a case which should have been before them and that they don't have jurisdiction. Powers to enforce recommendation, well, we've been talking about that for the past 2.5 years since I've taken over this office. And thank you. What you're simply saying there is you are enforcing what we've already been saying. Minimum sentences. I think I mentioned this at a previous meeting here in the committee, Mr. Chairman. I personally went to see the former President Mbeki about this. As a judge of the High Court, and I was a senior judge here in Cape Town, had been there for more than 20 years, went to see him and say, please reconsider minimum sentences. I wasn't thinking of correctional centres at that stage. I was thinking of sentences which are compulsory and which, like in the old days when you had to hang, when you had to impose a death penalty under certain circumstances, here you are doing something similar. And I've been against that all my life as a lawyer because to me it's not fair or just or reasonable. One just hopes that in the course of time it will no longer be necessary to have minimum sentence legislation. At this stage, of course, our office cannot make too much of an input there. If they ask us for our input, we'd be more than happy to give it. The question of work exercise, may I refer you to page 22-23 of the report? You'll see that the whole question of work and labor, we're not talking about hard labor as in the old days, in the bad old days. Section 40 of the Correctional Services Act says that the department is required, as far as practicable, those, of course, are the secret words which are often fallen back on because it's not practicable, they say, to provide sufficient work to keep offenders active for a normal working day. You know, nobody ever refers to the Section 40. I have no idea why not. Because this makes it so clear that, in fact, it is an injunction. They are compelled, they're obliged, they have the duty to give normal, to give work or to establish working activities for at least a full working day, which means 8 hours. And then Section 41 says it must be directed at furnishing the offender with skills which would enable him or her to be gainfully employed in society. This is all part of rehabilitation. It's all part of reintegration. Establish what the best kind of skill is that you must teach this person so that when he or she leaves the center, they will be able to be reintegrated into the community. That is what rehabilitation is all about, and that is what the work is that we are looking at. I've said, you know, if I were in prison, I would say I'm prepared to mow lawns and tend gardens. I don't care. I don't have to do legal work. But just get me outside to get fresh air and exercise. And that's really what it's all about. But look at what the department should be doing and look what it's not doing. It's keeping these people in their cells for 23 hours a day. As far as the question of, let me just move to the next page. I think I can't recall the answer question, but the autopsy of a person from a family, which is a person who has committed suicide, and where there are very strong indications that this is not a natural, it's not a natural death, it's an unnatural death, or where a person has been regarded as having suffered or died a natural death, and yet there are suspicious circumstances. I've discussed this before in this committee. That's why we want every single death to be investigated, because we have serious doubt as to whether or not the so-called natural deaths are in fact natural, whether they were preventable deaths, yes or no. Because if it was preventable, then there is somebody who must be called to account for that death, and don't just escape that accountability by calling it a natural death. Natural causes and natural death are not the same thing, and we've discussed that before. The OPCAT aspect, I think you dealt with that as well, Mr. Max. Of course, the moment OPCAT comes into operation, it's going to have an effect on us. We agree if the easiest way out is to extend our power so that we in fact become that national preventive mechanism, we're already doing it. So it seems to be the logical way out, because this doesn't necessitate the creation of a new body if you already have a body which is substantially doing the work. So that's all we say is please just bear that in mind before you ratify, so that we know how it's going to be implemented. Madam Yolanda, yes. Are JICs allowing people to sleep on single beds? And of course we're not allowing it. We complain about it. You know, I wrote a very strongly worded report about triple-decker bunks. Three beds, one on top of the other, and the person fell from the top bunk and broke his neck. He's dead. We had three cases. Nothing has been done. We haven't even got any response to that. To that letter I wrote to the minister, it came to the portfolio committee. And I said, what's happening? Have they removed those triple-decker bunks? Scaffolding, they call them. It's as dangerous as scaffolding. It's a shocking situation. And putting bunks together and saying, okay, now you four must sleep together. No wonder we've got people dying of AIDS, because that is the best way to get people sexually aroused as well. That's not what you want. How can that ever be regarded as a dignified way of dealing with anybody? They're entitled to those rights, to be treated with dignity, and they're not. Then the question of an inmate who was suffocated by whom? I wish I knew. If we were able to establish that, we would. But the person who did the suffocation, you would need a fully fledged investigation of a very inquisitorial nature to be able to establish who. And the person who did the suffocation probably no longer is alive or is no longer there. But that is the kind of thing which should be investigated, and these things are not being investigated. The internal investigations, I think, are really very superficial, generally speaking. Education, rehab, yeah. We have had cases of people who say, I want to study. I was in standard 8. I was in grade 10 when I was arrested, like in the one case that Ms. Karnow referred to. I've been here for 2 years. The case that she mentions, the wrong place, the wrong time. Somebody just happens to be there. I've referred to the curious onlooker who was arrested along with everybody else. How must he be expected to disprove that he is guilty? Because it's not his burden to disprove his guilt. It's for the state to prove that he is guilty. And if you don't have against that particular person as an individual sufficient evidence, then that person must be released, because you are breaching one of his most basic human rights, his right to liberty, his right to freedom. And then I think there was a reference to page 38, and that's number 2, which was there. Oh, yes. Detention of unsentenced girls. Well, we were there. Mr. Morris was there with me. It was purely by accident. We were walking around purely by accident, and we saw this one. It was a storeroom. A storeroom with no windows, which had been converted into a cell, and there was something like, can you remember how many girls there were? There were about 26 plus girls. You know what? They were lying naked on those beds, with men passing by there all the time, looking through the doors with great curiosity. You know why? Because it was so hot in those cells. It was 30, 35 degrees. That they didn't suffocate there, that they, you know, that you didn't have death there. Maybe they did, we didn't know about them. But the fact of the matter is, I expressed my absolute disgust at the situation and said, these people, have you ever tried to establish whether or not they can be released on bail? Or if they have, if they're unable to pay bail, because there were certain among them who weren't able to pay bail, bail had been set at something like 300 rand or something, they couldn't pay it. In terms of the Act, you have the right as the head of that centre to say, the situation in my centre is of such a nature that I cannot keep these people here, so please reconsider the conditions of bail. It's not happening. Once again, a very strongly worded letter, a report to the minister and to this committee, and from the department, we have had no indication whatever that they've improved that situation, or that these girls, these children, have been removed from that makeshift storeroom. So that's the kind of thing. Unfortunately, we're in their hands, and that is part of our frustration. I hope I'm not becoming too emotional about it, but we're very frustrated by that situation. And I think that deals with it. Maybe Mr. Morris can deal with the other aspects of the contract workers, and he'll be finished.
It's just in terms of the Labour Relations Act, they distinguish between an independent contractor and, of course, an employee. Now, an employee, it also includes all forms of contract appointments, people on contract, but it does not include independent contractors. So it's a bit of a technical question, Mr. Self, but we have gone to a lot of effort to make sure that we design the system in such a way that these people operate not as contract workers, but as independent contractors. And it also comes back to the question that Ms. Ngwena was asking in terms of, remember, the independent visitors are only paid for the hours that they spend inside the prison. If they don't go, they don't get paid. So they have to send us an invoice at the end of the month. They don't get paid automatically. They send us an invoice at the end of the month, and also we measure their performance against a set standard of service delivery. Ms. Kikano and Ms. Nene will attest to it that in terms of the contract, they have to visit the prison so many times. They have to interview inmates so many times. If they don't perform that function, if, for instance, they don't attend the visitors committee meeting, the hours is deducted by 4 hours, they don't get paid for it. Because as an independent contractor, you pay for what you do. And I must say that the sustainability of the system under the circumstances really depends very strongly on that audit function and the control measures that we've put in place. And I wish to just say that in the 12 years, we've never had a successful challenge against us on these issues. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Judge, and to your team. We've come to the end of the proceedings. Two things from our side. We will write a letter to the Department of Justice and to the Portfolio Committee, alerting them to the possibility of duplications in terms of CAT, and encouraging them to leverage on what exists currently. So we will do that immediately, so that we at least give an opportunity to make a presentation, if at all. On the second one, and this was the proposal that I I had decided on earlier, and I think many members, in fact, alluded to it as we spoke. We're meeting the department on Wednesday, and we were going to deal with Public Works, Kimberley. I want to propose that we take an hour out of that 9 to 1 meeting and ask the department to respond to these matters. Yeah. We will write to them and say to them, there will be two agenda items. You'll come and report on what you needed to report on in terms of Kimberley, even if it means we must release the DPW at that point and then do the things that you are saying is not being done, and ask them specifically to come and give us their initial responses to your report. You've empowered us in terms of what you've given us. We'll hear what they are saying, and then we can have an interrogation around that. So I'm proposing that we do that, Mr. Stiles.
Chair, I think that's a very good idea, but could I ask, in supplementing that, that you said you asked them to provide us with something in writing beforehand so that we have some sort of idea of how much further interrogation we need to do before they come.
We normally ask for 7 days. The time is just about 7 days, so they might on a technicality say to us, well, you normally give us 7 days, but we will do that. We will ask them to prepare for interaction on this report, and as far as possible, even if it's a day before, they must give us their written, and then we'll share with you whatever we get before the time, and you are welcome to come and sit in as observers on Wednesday. We will find a venue big enough, Cindy, for DPW, Stepford, and also DCS. Sir?
I just wanted to second that, but on the basis of that, the judge said that they have given the report to them long time ago. In other words, these 7 days may apply to you by reminding them what they have already done. It won't be your first letter. It will be the response to them. How they have they responded to these recommendations? That's how I see it.
No, that's fine. So we will write those two letters today, one to the Justice Portfolio Committee and the Department of Justice, as you are indicating they're involved in this, just to alert them, and then we will send a letter out slightly amending our agenda to have an hour set aside for this report, and you're welcome to observe, as I said, everyone else is welcome to observe. Meeting adjourned until next week, Mr. Self.
Yeah, on a completely different matter. The whips of my party have been on to me about the report and certain objections to the formulation of the report that is due to be tabled. I wondered whether you could shed any light on it.
I can't. I'm hearing it from you for the first time. Maybe I know the whips are meeting now, but to answer your question, I've received no formal indication one way or the other. As soon as I do that, we will. But I mean, from where I'm sitting, and I don't know what the contents are, but from where I'm sitting, it can't be amended unless it comes to this full session. That's my understanding, unless it's something else. But to answer your question, no, I haven't been informed formally. Otherwise, we would have put it on the agenda today to do the amendment. Meeting adjourned. Thank you.